The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Name versus McKesson Drug. Mr. Piskorski.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Piskorski, and I appear on behalf of defendants appellants McKesson Corporation and Dan Montreal. From the outset of the lawsuit with the filing of the complaint through post-verdict pleadings, the plaintiff continuously and explicitly linked her intentional infliction of emotional distress claim under Illinois law to unlawful retaliation and discrimination prohibited not only by Title VII but by the Illinois Human Rights Act. At pages 18 through 22 of our opening brief, we review all of those pleadings in which the plaintiff engaged in that linkage, including arguments to the jury. Even the district court acknowledged the linkage between the intentional infliction claim and the retaliation claim. At plaintiff's appendix, AAA, page 11, the court talks about a particular act about which the plaintiff complains, and the court says, well, that could satisfy the intentional infliction standard if the jury concludes that McKesson acted with retaliatory animus. But the most powerful evidence demonstrating the linkage between the intentional infliction claim and retaliation and discrimination comes from the plaintiff herself in a post-verdict argument when she was arguing in support of the verdict. It's at record 186, page 13. It's important because it's so succinctly but explicitly stated. Quote, plaintiff argued and the jury found that defendant's conduct against plaintiff in 1995 and 1996 was impelled by a motive to retaliate because of her denial of promotion complaints in 1994. There clearly was a finding of retaliation, end quote. That's the plaintiff, again, linking her intentional infliction claim to discrimination and retaliation prohibited by the Illinois Human Rights Act, which means exclusive jurisdiction over that claim rested with the Illinois Department of Human Rights and the Illinois Human Rights Commission.
Well, you and your colleagues seem to be at odds on exactly what the preemption test is that the Illinois Supreme Court uses. Is that a fair characterization of your positions?
I do not, Your Honor. I think the standards, I don't find a disagreement between us. The standard is, are they inextricably linked? Is the intentional infliction claim inextricably linked to unlawful retaliation or unlawful discrimination? That's the standard.
And in your view, that's your colleague's view as well?
I believe it is, Your Honor, yes. At least that's how I read the brief. I'm not sure there's a disagreement over that. The question becomes, are the claims truly inextricably linked?
Is it fair to say there's a disagreement among the district court, you know, federal district courts in Illinois on how to interpret that, the preemption standard?
That is fair to say. This court's opinions in Honecker and Van Stan and Sanglap, they all lay out the standards pretty clear about the necessity for inextricable linkage. And the Illinois Supreme Court likewise has said that. So that is the standard. I think what we're quarreling about, if anything, is there such linkage in this case? And in this case, the plaintiff, in her own words, repeatedly and explicitly said there was such linkage. Her case was dependent upon it. And I think that's an important point. There's a reason why the plaintiff was repeatedly linking her intentional infliction claim to retaliation.
So where did the district court then go wrong? Is it a question of its misreading of the law or simply a misreading of fact?
Misreading of the law and of facts. The district court ultimately concluded that the acts about which the plaintiff complains underlying intentional infliction, independent of retaliation and discrimination, met the extreme and outrageous test of Illinois law. That was the district court's finding. Our position is number one, the district court incorrectly disregarded all of the plaintiff's statements and all of the plaintiff's arguments and all of the plaintiff's submissions. And then secondly, we just think the district court has it wrong when she evaluated the evidence and concluded that the conduct, whether you look at things individually or collectively, amounted to extreme and outrageous under Illinois law. But the plaintiff needed retaliation and discrimination for her claim because She had to convince the jury, why would these people, Dan Montreal, Hank Winemaster, Jan Hartley, the people there, why would they do things to her to hurt her and to cause emotional distress? She needed some explanation. Retaliation and discrimination provided that reason. And that was the theory pre-trial, during trial, post-trial.
This question obviously is an important one, and obviously one that's going to repeat itself. What is your view of, I believe it was your colleague who suggested that we ask the Illinois Supreme Court to deal with this preemption issue and tell us what the Illinois law is?
That's fine with me, although I'm not sure the law is as muddy at this level that perhaps the plaintiff wants to suggest. The Supreme Court has spoken about preemption in the Maksimovich case. This court has spoken on it on several occasions in various contexts. So I'm not sure what the certified issue would be. And I don't think in plaintiff's brief they specifically articulate what's the issue to be certified. If the court would want to send it to the or request consideration by the Supreme Court of Illinois, I would have no problem with that. And I think it's always beneficial if the state court kind of puts some meat on its state tort claim. Once having locked himself into preemption, now the argument is, and to get around preemption and to get around Sangley, the plaintiff now adopts the argument that my intentional infliction claim really has nothing to do with retaliation, has nothing to do with discrimination. The acts about which plaintiff complains, she now argues, independently rise to the level of extreme and outrageous conduct, which is required under Illinois law for such a claim. Several problems with that theory. One, obviously, as I mentioned, it contradicts the theory that was presented to the jury. Secondly, as I just talked about previously, without retaliation and discrimination, the plaintiff had no good case in front of a jury as to why anybody would want to hurt the plaintiff. So it was essential. More important, these people, Montreal and Winemaster, they weren't even around at the underlying charge, the events underlying the original charge. They weren't even there. They weren't involved in the EEOC proceeding. They weren't involved in the EEOC investigation. They had no interest and no stake personal in the EEOC case. So the plaintiff then has to come up, well, then why would they want to inflict emotional distress upon her? The answer and the argument made to the jury and to the district court was because they were retaliating against her for the EEOC proceeding. When you take out retaliation, when you take out discrimination, in the words of the court in Sanglap, you've taken the air out of the case. There's nothing left for purposes of extreme and outrageous conduct, which is necessary under Illinois law. The third problem with the plaintiff's argument is the acts about which...
Well, they just didn't like her.
That may be, Judge, and dislike, as the courts have said, it does not rise to extreme and outrageous conduct.
Well, it depends what they do if they... You know, if you accept what the jury must have accepted, that is requiring a very pregnant woman, overweight, to climb spiral stairs, to crawl under a desk to plug in computer equipment, that gets some distance to it, doesn't it?
Well, it may add some, but dislike in the workplace goes on all the time. What he needed, or what the plaintiff needed, to make the necessary leap to show extreme and outrageous conduct with some evil motive, some bad motive, more than I just didn't like her. Discrimination and retaliation provided the linchpin of that necessary argument. Since Your Honor brought it up, the record obviously is quite large. The trial went on for nearly 3 weeks. So there's a lot of evidence there. But the point is the rhetoric and the descriptive language contained in the plaintiff's brief, and there's a lot of it, ill will, spite, cruelty, personal dislike, all these things were tossed out. When you go behind the descriptive language in the brief and actually look at the record evidence, there's a huge disconnect. The evidence does not support the rhetorical conclusions. I'll address Your Honor's question regarding making her go climb and connect computer cables. That is the argument she was making, that She was ordered and directed to climb those stairs knowing that she was pregnant, and you get under the desk and connect the cables. That's not the evidence. The undisputed evidence, and it comes from Ms. Naeem herself, is that she was never personally told, you must do it. Connecting cables is part of the computer room function, and she was in charge of it. She could have and should have had others do it. In fact, maintenance workers had done it in the past. So it's not a new task she was being asked to do, her department was being asked to do, something that had always been done. She went to the maintenance people. They were working on a project. They could not take time to go do what she was wanting them to do. No one, there's no evidence saying that anybody went to the maintenance people and said, don't you help Ms. Naeem. Don't do it. This is all Ms. Naeem with the maintenance people. They're on a project. They said they can't do it. She then decides, I'll do it on my own, and climbs up the stairs and goes into the area, as many other people did as well. We're talking about one incident. One incident like that. I don't see anything in that record evidence from Ms. Naeem herself that causes anyone to say, wow, that's extreme, that's outrageous, wow, that's outrageous. So the characterization in the brief that we ordered her to engage in dangerous assignments, and that's the only incident that really underlies that rhetorical conclusion, it simply doesn't support it. If you go and actually read the hard testimony, there are many other examples of things like that. And I hate to go through the record, but we are arguing sufficiency of the evidence. And with this tough standard, this case is kind of appropriate for that review. For example, at page 30, she argues that she was required to perform two full-time jobs. Yeah, but she always had two full-time jobs. She was always head of the, for the most part, she was always head of the computer room and the transportation department. She held those two jobs in Houston, and after a time in Romeoville, she had those two jobs. It wasn't like we put the transportation function on her or the computer room function on her when she was pregnant. She had both functions. And she admits that until mid-1995, about June, she was handling both just fine. So there's no evidence to support, wow, they imposed two jobs on her. Another example that I think helps illustrate my point that the rhetoric doesn't match the evidence. She argues that Mr. Montreal had the transportation office demolished and the files dispersed. Well, when you hear that, you say, wow, that's pretty rough. I mean, they went out and just did that to her to demolish her office? Well, here's the undisputed evidence. At that time, there was a reconfiguration of the warehouse area. It was a big project, and they were installing a new conveyor, a new machine in there, and that reconfiguration and installation required an expansion of space. So they took her office and moved it near the computer room where other managers had their desks and materials. So the idea that we, again, in the words of the plaintiff, we demolished her office needs to be put in context, and that's the context. In terms of dispersing her files, well, the evidence came from the guy who moved the files. He said, whatever files were there, I moved them. Don't know what happened. I guess in a move, things get lost. But there's no evidence showing that any manager, Montreal or Winemaster or anyone, took those files, garbaged them, dispersed them, so that somehow they could inflict emotional distress. The plaintiff makes a significant argument at page 30 of her brief that when she complained in July of 1995 about too much work and my pregnancy causing problems, she was rudely rebuffed and then excoriated. Well, here's the record evidence on that point. She sends a letter July 17th in which she says, quote, a number of issues as well as my maternity issue have combined to require me to ask for some reasonable accommodation in the workload I am currently carrying. 3 days later, she meets with Montreal and Hartley, and I believe Winemaster as well. And at the conclusion of the meeting, they tell her, we'll help you. And give us a list of the things you want us to accommodate you on. That's from Ms. Naeem. That's the evidence from the plaintiff herself. That's hardly rudely rebuffed and then excoriated. That's coming from her. So when you go through the, and in plaintiff's brief, there are a number of these alleged acts. If you look at them piece by piece, as well as collectively. When you actually go and look at the evidence, which we've tried to do in our briefs, there doesn't correspond between the rhetorical conclusion and the actual evidence. Plaintiff also overlooks the fact that, here's an undisputed fact, in August of 1995, right in the middle of this alleged plot, scheme, whatever you want to call it, to inflict this emotional distress upon her, they give her a meets expectation rating and a raise. Well, if I'm trying to inflict emotional distress on somebody, I'm not going to do that. But that's a fact that's overlooked. Everything that the plaintiff complains about are not uncommon occurrences in the workplace. Everything she complains about, too much work, not enough support, unfair discipline, that goes on every day in almost every workplace in the country. There's nothing in this record that leads one to exclaim outrageous, atrocious, it transcends all bounds of decency, the kind of standards that this court and the Illinois courts have always used to describe this very narrow and very narrowly tailored tort. A couple of other key points in the record that's undisputed. What was expected from Ms. Naeem was expected from the other managers. Yeah, maybe a lot was demanded of her, but everybody a lot was demanded from. Number two, she places great reliance on the fact that she was a lot of this occurred while she was pregnant. Yes, but critical. The pregnancy, she went on leave on July 24th. She complained in writing on July 17th. She then went on leave. So everything after she returned on November 1, she no longer can in linchpin on, well, I was pregnant, and therefore that exacerbates what they were asking me to do. I think that's an important distinction in timing. Also, in the brief, they point to various actions by Mr. Winemaster. Well, critically,
when she was placed on these special programs to get her to shape up, was that after the pregnancy leave?
Yes. The performance improvement plan was given to her on November 15th, 1995. She had returned to work on October 31, 1995. And last point before I save my rebuttal, Mr. Winemaster. There are references in plaintiff's brief to actions by Mr. Winemaster. The jury found in favor of Mr. Winemaster on the intentional infliction claim. So plaintiff, at minimum, needs to peel that out of the equation, but she has not. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Pekarsky. Mr. Gigas?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Your Honors, I think the first thing I'd like to do is deal with, and if you have any questions, we can direct ourselves to a closer attention to the detail, but the Supreme Court of Illinois essentially has dispensed with the argument of the appellant in this case in the Maximovic case, and there have been other cases that are subsequent to it, both of the district courts downstairs, and I think around this district, but primarily in the Northern District and in the appellate courts, in holding that the question of linkage depends on independence of legal theory. And I'll read from the Maximovic holding. The case is reported at 177 Illinois 2nd, 511. We conclude that a common law tort is not inextricably linked with a civil rights violation where a plaintiff can establish the necessary elements of the tort independent of any legal duties created by the Illinois Human Rights Act. In such a case, the plaintiff has established a basis for imposing liability on the defendant independent of any statutory cause of action under the Act, and therefore the Circuit Court does have jurisdiction. That is essentially, I think, almost verbatim the test that Judge Gottschall applied in.
From this, I gather you do not agree with your colleague then that the two sides in this case are in agreement on the legal standard.
That's right, Your Honor. I was surprised that he said that. My brief could not be clearer, I don't think, that they're only taking half of legal issue. The history of it, of the rule in the Illinois Supreme Court, inextricable intertwining, comes from the Geise case, which is a 1994 case of the Illinois Supreme Court. And then in Maximovic, the facts of the case were essentially that the acts and the motivation of the defendant in the case were so interlinked. What would happen, it was basically a sexual assault case. And the plaintiff in that case filed both an Illinois human rights case and then filed an Illinois common law action based on torts of assault and battery and the like. There's no separation, really, between the question of motivation and exactly what happened, between the legal theory in the Human Rights Commission, even though it's not apparent in the record, it's obvious as a matter of logic, and the common law tort. And the Supreme Court dealt very clearly with it in the section that I've read to your honors. The Sanglap case is a case that allows sort of a, what's the way to look at it? And Sanglap says, if not in exactly these words, something like this, that if you strip the conduct of the elements giving rise to the duties, giving rise to the human rights violation, in this case, if you strip this case of the retaliatory motive, are you still able, is the plaintiff still able to state a cause of action simply under the Illinois common law, in this case, intentional infliction of emotional distress? There's absolutely no question in this case that it is, that's what happened here. Now, it is true, and I have conceded in my brief and throughout, indeed, this case, that our argument below was largely based on retaliation for the EEOC. No question about that. On the other hand, throughout the case, in the original complaint, in the pretrial order, during the course of the trial, and especially in closing argument, we essentially said, ladies and gentlemen, in closing, for example, we don't have to prove a motive. Whatever the motive in this case was, that they wanted to protect one of the other employees, they wanted to do this, even if it was mere cruelty, the conduct here that these people committed against my client is extreme and outrageous. And so the essence of the argument of the appellant in this case is essentially confusion. What they try to do is, first of all, confuse the legal test by removing the Maximovic element of independence, if you can establish independence. And then the second part of it is essentially to ignore the fact that, as a matter of fact, our proof stands independent as to conduct irrespective of motivation. And the central point here has to do with the instructions. This jury was carefully instructed, and the instruction conferences are not included in my appendix or in the brief, but they were painful. They were detailed. They were controversial. They were professional throughout, but we really, really worked over every line of almost every instruction, especially intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the fact of the matter is, this jury was instructed in accordance with the standard elements of intentional infliction, and there's no requirement that we have to prove a motive. There is absolutely no requirement in the basic. And so we think the evidence is absolutely clear in this case that using the test, combining Maximovic, using the rubric, the test, the method suggested by Sanglap, that you strip retaliation out, that the conduct here is essentially, it's just unacceptable in a civilized workplace. And I would move on essentially to address what is the sufficiency argument. Counsel, having confused motivation with conduct, Your Honor made that point to him. Whatever it is they were thinking, whatever motivated them, there's a difference between why they did it and what they did. So let's look at just what they did. Well, the first thing that they admit, first in importance later in the case of the trial, was the fact they intended to affect this lady's mental processes. We quote that excerpt from the trial transcript in our brief, and it was just as explicit as could be. They intended to affect this lady's mind. They admitted it was part of their defense. It was adduced on direct examination in the first place, and then I cross-examined essentially to ask, did I understand you to say you intended to affect this lady's mental processes? And the witness, Ms. Hartley, said, yes, that's correct, but for the better. And I said, well, you don't mind if the jury decides if it's for the better or not? She said, no, I don't. The question has to do with the second part of the intentional infliction instruction. If you intend to inflict emotional distress, assuming you do it and there is distress. That's one way to prove it. The other one is if your conduct creates a high probability that emotional distress will be affected. So whatever her desire or their intention was to help for the better, the fact of the matter of what they is that what they did went so beyond the pale of normal workday routine stresses and disagreement, which is essentially the language of both the Supreme Court case in Illinois, the appellate cases, the district court cases, and most importantly for our purposes, the Honecker case, which this court has decided, which essentially captures the test. It's got to be more than the rough and tumble, the routine rough and tumble of an employment situation. And this case involves such a thing. First, as a matter of appellate procedure, I am struck by the argument of my opponent in this case regarding the detailed nature of the evidence, what it shows and what it doesn't show. Their briefs, both of their briefs, are very, very almost useless in permitting the court to examine that. There is no record citations that are included in an appendix. They do not, as required by the rules of the court, make a fair recitation of the facts, which includes all the evidence. When we are up here on these motions, they have to include all the evidence, including the evidence against them. They can't come up and make a one-sided, essentially, jury argument. And that's essentially what counsel has done in his oral argument, and it's not supported by either their main brief or their reply brief.
Counsel, would you go over this up the spiral stairwell and staircase and the computer hookups?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm pleased to do that as I direct my attention to it. I'll see if I can find where it is. Where it is in my brief. It's on page 7 of my brief. It's the first full paragraph. And the brief says, and I don't like to read in arguments, and I know it's disapproved, but I'll just read the paragraph. This is what the brief says. And it's a summary. The word limitations in this case made it very difficult for me to amplify on some of this stuff. They assigned her tasks that endangered her and her baby's physical safety, the most serious of which was requiring her to climb a dangerous rickety metal stairway into the warehouse attic and crawl under furniture and equipment to connect commuter cables. They instructed the maintenance staff to keep working on another project and not assist her. I'll have to go back and look at the brief. I thought it was responsive sufficiently to what the appellants were arguing in this case. It may be that I might ask leave to supplement to point the court to the record, but essentially what happened, to answer Your Honor's question, was that she was responsible for two jobs, one of which was the computer room. They had been increasing her responsibilities, and some of the responsibilities involved basically technical issues, technical in the sense of connecting stuff. And at the time, she was grossly overweight and suffering from a very, very difficult pregnancy. She had essentially two or three medical conditions that were serious. One, she had gestational diabetes. That's one thing. Number two, she had hypotension, which is low blood pressure. And number three, she was suffering from various bouts of vertigo, of dizziness. And there's no question in the record that the medical leave certificates show that the people involved in this case, including her supervisor, knew about it. For one thing, you look at somebody who is 45 pounds overweight and pregnant, you know that this lady is suffering. And indeed, she had complained both to her boss and to the personnel director about the fact that the job had gotten too much and she was suffering because of her pregnancy. And she had been rebuffed, but not just rebuffed, rudely rebuffed and cruelly rebuffed.
Let me ask you about there was other maintenance people who would normally have been assisting her. Your opponent says that they were just on another project and they didn't have time to help her. I think you infer, or at least indicate, that they were told not to.
That's right, and I think that's the testimony of my client. My client's testimony, which came in, and I don't have it right in front of me, Your Honor, but my recollection of it is what she said was that she went to the maintenance staff and she asked them to do it for her, and they said no, they'd been told not to help her out. Something to that point. I'll have to go back and look in the precise testimony of the transcript. And that came in essentially unobjected to. And there is testimony as well that I remember from Mr. Montreal himself, who basically said it didn't make any difference that they weren't unavailable, that they couldn't help her. I wanted it done, and I wanted it done right away, And she had to go up and do it, period. That was the sense of the sense of the testimony, and not only the sense, Your Honor, when you talk about the cold record, not conveying it in the way that this trial judge and jury saw it, the tone that I have just given it to you, somewhat theatrical, really does reflect, I think, the way that it, and it comes through in the words of the transcript, what this gentleman was saying. And so she had to climb up a rickety staircase, and she had to climb under tables at a time when she was suffering. And it's corroborated in the medical records. The medical records, Your Honor, show that after the meeting that my learned opponent suggests was just a routine, let's see if we can help you meeting, down further on page 7, Your Honor, I described that, I think, in much more correct and vivid detail. The people were angry, insulting, intolerant, abusive, told her that she would receive no additional help, that her staff would be cut further, and that he, Montreal, expected her to continue performing both full-time jobs. Plaintiff's Exhibit 23 is her medical chart. Either at that point in the medical chart, and I refer to it on page 7, or somewhere else in the entry, on the chart itself, is a report that she'd been forced to go to the attic in the warehouse and was dizzy as a result of it. And I'm almost sure, Your Honor, that it's contained in my brief.
Does the record reflect, with regard to these assigned responsibilities, whether or not Ms. Naeem had any assistance within her own area of responsibility, or was she the only person who could do it when she did not get aid from, from the maintenance department?
That was essentially the point that Mr. Montreal made, that if there was no one else, and Mrs. Naeem said there was nobody else, if there was no one else, she was expected to do it herself. That was the substance of his testimony.
But on the question, if there was anyone else, is there any evidence in the record that there wasn't anyone else? What was the staffing? Does the record reflect what staffing existed in the areas where she had responsibility?
Well, Your Honor, directly pointed to the question of climbing up into the attic, I'm not sure I recall that the record has evidence about it. I think the clear inference from it, and we're entitled to that benefit, is there was no one else but the maintenance men who couldn't do it. She thought they were told not to do it. Montreal said she had to do it, so she went and did it. The inference is that there was no one else to help her on that project. There is testimony, however, about the assistance that she had in the performance of her other jobs. Before they changed the job, she had some assistance, and then they took the purse on the computer, on the transportation room, record-keeping assistance to do fine. Then they took that away, and she went to one of her coworkers who was who testified in the case, Stephanie Kozlowskis, and Stephanie Kozlowskis did some of the work in the filings for just before and after Mrs. Naeem left. And then when they destroyed her or moved, as counsel said, we're prepared to accept that characterization for the purposes of argument. When they moved her office, Ms. Kozlowska stopped doing the work, and all this stuff never got filed. That's essentially the only people who were available to help this lady. Nobody else. Now, of course, she had staff in the computer room. I think the evidence shows that. But that staff was essentially, there were, excuse me for saying it in this way, but there were other female employees who were basically key punch operators. And so they were not available to do this. And Montreal said, I think, Your Honor, in the testimony, that she was expected to do it if the maintenance people could not do it. So I hope that's responsive to Your Honor's questioning. Now, there is a...
Counsel, let me ask you. On page 7 again, you said by mid-July she was working 12 to 15 hours a day at two full-time jobs. Was she salaried or was she an hourly employee?
She was a salaried employee. She was salaried. And counsel makes the point, I think I've just alluded to it, that she'd been performing these two jobs before. The difficulty with that is it completely ignores the evidence in the case that basically 2 years earlier they were in a budget crunch, so they terminated the fellow who was doing the transportation job. and her supervisor, Jerry Moultrie, came to her and under a pretext said, you know, it'll be good for your career if you do this, when really what he wanted to do is combine the jobs in one employee. And she did get something of a raise for it. And he said, don't worry about it. I'm not going to put too much pressure on you. We'll give you slack. One thing happened, another thing happened. People left. All the history of this case happened. By the time we get to June of 1995, there she is in these two jobs, and they had been escalating the job requirements. So it's not fair to say, as they do, and this is a matter of evidence, both explicit and inference that we're entitled to in this stage of the proceeding, it's not fair to say that she had been able to handle these two jobs before, because they were essentially completely changed. And the recitation of the evidence, when one duty was piled on top of another duty on top of another duty, essentially is contained in a summary description in my factual statement in my brief. And the two jobs were basically impossible to perform. And there is evidence of it, explicit evidence of it, in my client's memorandum that was written in July that led to this meeting that counsel describes as relatively routine. Nothing routine about the meeting, but the document itself shows a litany of complaints about the increase in her responsibilities beyond what she had been required to do before, when they were not as intolerable. So, Your Honors, we think that this is a case of absolutely clear abuse of power. There are several elements in the employment context that are outlined in our brief from both the Illinois appellate courts and the courts here. And this is not a case, as counsel suggests, as the appellant suggests in their reply briefs, where you have to have assault and battery, basically, to constitute intentional infliction of emotional distress. The law recognizes that as the Honecker case did, that the employment context is a place, especially where there is abuse of power, and the people who are abusing the power have the power and the likelihood that that power will be abused. There's not a question here that somebody, this is not a question of threats. This is a question of making this lady actually do the things that she did, working 12 to 18 hours a day, et cetera. Your Honor, we ask for an affirmance on the count. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gickes. Ms. Pekarsky.
Three points, Your Honors. One, the reference to Maximovich. I'm happy to have Maximovich be a key case here. That case, the conduct truly was outrageous. It involved what I would describe as sexually perversive conduct on the part of a manager. And I won't go through the facts, but it's a really, really bad case. And the court pointed out that all of the plaintiff's allegations in that case constituted independent torts under Illinois law: battery, assault, false imprisonment. There are no independent torts here. Nothing was asked of or required of the plaintiff which constitutes an unlawful act under Illinois law. Everything that was asked of her was legitimate and part of her job responsibilities. There's no dispute about that. She concedes that everything she was asked to do was part of her computer room job and part of her transportation office job. She just thought it was too much to do, okay? But it's part of her job. If the tort is recognized based on this factual record, we believe it will present what I would describe as almost an ominous extension of what is intended to be a very narrow and limited tort. Everything the plaintiff identifies is all work-related and directly related to her job responsibilities. If an employee believes the workload is too much, or a discipline is unfounded, or she's not given enough time to do a job, if those elements become sufficient to state a claim for intentional infliction, your many, many claims now will become intentional infliction. Two other brief points, evidentiary-wise. The comment about Ms. Hardley affecting the plaintiff's mental processes. She said it. The context of the statement was, through counseling and through the performance improvement plans and through the disciplinary write-ups, we were trying to address performance problems and help her correct them. So, yes, they were trying to affect her mental processes in assistance to satisfactorily perform her jobs. And on the staircase incident, just so the court has it, the transcript cites are pages 1154 to 57, 1395 through 1400. We covered it page 4 of our reply. All the employees were required to use the staircase that she used. It's not like it was something just for her. The other undeniable fact in that testimony is she was supposed to have hooked these cables up before, and she had not done that. So it's not like there was an instantaneous do it now. It was a request and a directive that had been around for a bit. That's in her words. Also, the maintenance people had helped her before. And on this project, they were doing something else at the time. There is no evidence that Montreal or anyone else went to those guys and said, don't you help her. I want her to do it. There's no any evidence that Montreal said, you personally do it. He said, you get it done, but she's the manager of the department, and it's a function that she had always been required to perform. I'm out of town. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Pekarsky. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.